And we are live, and just a few minutes earlier than scheduled today, and I was sitting here going, I got 4 minutes before the official start time, and I can't really get anything else done, and let's do it, because I'm hard charging this week. I'm trying to get an awful lot done. I'm flying out of here super early on Wednesday morning, heading up to Tennessee for the Living Free in Tennessee workshop, where I'll be presenting a couple classes. One on biochar and one on building a bioreactor. So we'll be doing those up there, and that means I won't be here. And that means that tomorrow, I know I said you were only going to get one rewind this week. You're going to get two. Don't worry, they'll be good. Thursday's expert camp panel show is absolutely going to happen, and I can tell you how I know it's going to happen. I just did it. I just finished it. It's already on the blog. You can't see it yet. It's scheduled. It will self-publish at like 7 o'clock in the morning on Thursday, and you'll get a Friday flashback, and I won't forget because that was done last week. So that's already ready to go. So all I got left in my week this week is two shows. And why do I have that flexibility? Because I run my own business. I didn't have to go, boss, dear boss, may I please be able to leave for a couple of days? No, I just decided like I want to leave, and this is the circumstances I want to leave under, and I don't want to leave no shows up. So I just took initiative and did it because I own a business. And that's what we're going to talk about today. The fact that building a business, for all the fluff that gets thrown around by entrepreneurial mentors and stuff like that, it's actually hard. It's actually really hard to build a business. Specifically to build a business to a point where you can sustain the business from the revenue and the business itself, pay yourself decently, and not work for other people. There's a lot of people who have built businesses, and I'm not poo-pooing on it, but they're designed in a way that they will probably never be anything other than side hustle. They either cannot scale logistically the way they were designed, and they weren't meant to, or they can't scale because of the market opportunity within that business. You'd have to expand it to expand the business. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I hope if you listen to the show today and you don't want a full-time business and you want a side hustle, it inspires you as much. But getting all the way to the point where you have a business that when somebody says, hey, do you want to go out to dinner on Friday? If you don't want to go, it's because you don't want to go. It's not because you can't afford to. And all you have is a business, that kind of business, it's hard. And by the end of the day today, you're going to see why that's a good thing, not a bad thing. I think a lot of people think it's bad that it's hard. Well, something's valuable because it's rare. Let's stick that in your bonnet, and we will come back to it in just a minute. I don't have a lot of housekeeping today. I just want to real quick remind you guys about my book. My book is coming out on May the 12th, not May the 4th. May the 12th be with you. It is the 16 laws of life that are the primary things by which I've built this business. I've built this community and its sub-communities, and I've built everything that I have in my life, how I've built my family, how I've built my homestead. All of it is about the lifestyle design that goes into it. This book would be great for anybody who's trying to build a better life. It doesn't matter if they want to be in the world of business or entrepreneurship or not. It would benefit them. I think ideally this book is really suited for about 15 to 35 year olds. I think if 75 year old could read it and get a lot out of it, they'd also be like, yeah, I know that. There is a real lack of kind of this underlying ethic, a morality, work ethic in our society today. And as I always say when I talk about Jack's laws of life, they are Jack's laws of life in that I have adopted them into my life and I have codified them to a degree and made them work in a way that functions for me. And I attribute a lot of my success to this. But they're not mine in that I didn't author them. This is not a religious text. Most of this stuff is in some ways at least partially well known, but I've taken it to another level. I've worked really hard on this. This was years coming. Looking at the proofs, there's still a typo or three in there. It is what it is at this point. I'm more worried about getting the message out to all of you that agree to be ambassadors. Thank you. There is one gold ambassador position left. The silvers and the platinums are gone. We oversold the silver a little bit. I guess we don't really sell it, but we have more than 50 signups. It's like four extras. I'm just going to leave them there because it didn't go too crazy before I caught it and shut off the form with it. But right now, if you have a form and fill it out today, you can either select gold or I'm just buying one for me. I'm sure by the end of this show, I'll update that and the form will just be an announcement. But if you want to make sure that you're informed about this book coming out, when it's coming out, and some other really cool stuff that goes along with it, just fill the form out for yourself and you'll get an email probably a week before, a day before, and the morning of. That's really all that book or all that list is designed to do. But there'll be more after the fact. And I do want to let you know, I just made a real brief announcement that I was thinking about doing a AI ChatGPT course in the coming months. And it would be something along the lines of you get an instruction a day and then a private Telegram group to communicate with each other about it. Very similar to one that was done, I can't think of his name, I just went out of my head, but the guy I've had on a couple times about AI, except I thought I could do it better and angle it a little bit better. And what I've come up with is really designed to fit with what we're talking about today, building a business. And it will be great for people to side hustle an existing business or want to establish a business, but I got so much positive feedback, we are going to do it. And it's 90% done. It wasn't actually that hard to do, but I will tell you that stay tuned for it. You won't hear much more about it this week. You'll hear about it when I get back from the Kohl's. If you want to build a business, and even if you're not sure, but you want to at least poke around the idea and learn to use this tool a lot better at the same time, the value that this is going to give you is insane. And when I drop what I plan to drop on you at the end, and it will be, I will never tell you what it is until it happens, a lot of you are going to be like, holy crap, I can't believe he did that. Anyway, with that, let's get into today's subject, which again, we're talking about building a business today, and we're talking about why building a business is hard, and eventually we'll get to why that's good. I want to start off with, though, most people that talk about building businesses, especially in podcasts, TikTok videos, social media in general, YouTube channels and all, they may eventually get around to this, but they seldom lead off with it. They seldom do an episode. This is freaking hard, right? And they seldom like bring that in all the time to their content. And if you notice, like every time I talk about business, even if it's kind of like a you can do it episode, it's still like it's going to be hard as shit. And I think some people might wonder, why do you do that? Well, I do it for the same reason. If I talk about diet and I talk about going keto or carnivore or something about like that, I always tell people about keto flu. And I remember when Dorothy and I first did this and it worked out so well for us, and we started having our friends ask us, and I'm talking real in real life conversations. And when they would start talking about it, I would always say, like, if you do this, one thing you should know is it's actually really simple to do, but it can be hard, especially initially. And I tell them about keto flu. I tell them about how, you know, I got little boils on me basically as my body was detoxing, about how sometimes, you know, it takes a while to adjust and you can have flu-like symptoms and all. My wife would be kicking me under the table. Why are you doing that? Well, here's why. If you don't tell a person that and they go make this radical shift to their diet and they observe these negative consequences and they're not prepared for that and understand like this is temporary, then what they say is, well, I tried it and it didn't work. And you ask them, well, what do you mean you tried it? They did it like 4 days and they didn't feel good, so they quit. Now, if somebody had told them, look, it's very possible that in the first few 3-4 weeks even, you'll have some negative feedback, but this is your body adapting to leaving the carbohydrate addiction, and it's also your body reacting to your rapidly burning fat cells early on, and you store toxins in there, and you're going to be dumping those into your body, and there's going to be some negative feedback initially, but it will go away. And here's some things you can do to mediate that. Then they're more likely to stay on the diet. Yes, I may get, you know, out of 10, let's say that 5 will try it that I talk to about it if I just do all lilies and roses. But I might get 5 to try it doing that and get, you know, 2 or 1 that actually get through the other side of it and experience the benefit, because they weren't prepared, where maybe I'll only get 4 if I prep them, but I'll get 3 or 4 all the way through the process. And that's what I want to do with business. I always want people to understand there will be sacrifices. There will be trade-offs. And if you don't understand that, you're not going to get through the freaking blood, sweat, and tears it takes. Now, every once in a while, somebody just hits it and it just works. And that's great when it happens. And I got people in this audience like, I thought I would try this little thing and I put it on and we went to some farmers markets and then I got a website and then started selling that. And then somebody told somebody else and like Now we're making 150 grand a year and it was never hard. Okay. And somebody will also write in and say, so Jack, I went to the convenience store and I bought a lottery ticket and I scratched it off and son of a gun, I won $500,000. But you shouldn't now make that your plan, right? Like playing the lottery is a good way to piss away your money, in my opinion. That doesn't mean nobody ever wins. If nobody ever won, it wouldn't work. Like nobody would buy it if nobody ever won, right? So you can have it easy, but you probably won't. Now, one of the things that often leads to businesses becoming successful, even if they have to get through the hard period, is what I call a rational exuberance. And I don't ever want to kick anybody's irrational exuberance in the balls and just paralyze it. But I might want to smack it around a little bit, right? But first we have to define, what do I mean when I say irrational exuberance? My way of defining irrational exuberance as it relates to this episode today is being so motivated that you ignore anything that would get in your way and just do shit anyway until such time as you figure out what works for you. You become so excited, so project orientated, like you come up with this idea for a business and you think how, like, and you make a little bit of a plan, just enough to get it off the ground and get it moving in the right direction. I'll market this way and I'll do that. And a lot of it's never going to happen because as you put the battle plan to work, some things in your mind that are going to work will and some won't. But you'll get off zero with a rational exuberance. This is freaking wonderful. This is where passion and opportunity overlap, and you have the vision to see that. It doesn't mean it will always work, but it will almost always get a person off zero if they are ever going to get off zero. Let me be clear. Some people will never get off zero here. Some people, you could line out the entire business. Here's your follow-up email series, right? Here's your copy for you. You could give them a literal business in a box in a unique niche that they actually know how to deliver on. And they go, man, I'd really like to do that. But, and like, I'm not talking to you today if that's you. You're not ready for this. And you may never be. And that's okay. Not everybody's going to do this, but I think everybody can learn from it. But when you have irrational exuberance, you get off zero. And that's really beneficial. But there are some downsides to it. I want to hit both of them. Let's start off with the advantage. But there's many ways to succeed. A lot of times when people will come to someone who's got business experience and has been successful, they come to that person as a mentor because they're like, well, they'll tell me what to do. And if you're the kind of, you're like, trust me, I've done this, and a lot of people want to be told what to do, but that doesn't necessarily they're going to do it. But I'm, you know, there are people that, like, if you say do these things, they'll go do them. They'll go do them. They'll go get them done. But the problem with you going to somebody else and trying to get that much of a clear blueprint of what to do and how to do exactly that is that there is not one way for any business to succeed. There's multiple ways. And the beauty of the rational exuberance is as long as you have the capability of putting out the message, delivering the message, and delivering the service or product on the other side, it'll get you going. It'll get you started. It will get you off zero. That's really, really great. And what will happen is you will find one of the ways to be successful. Because if you are in that mode and you can stay in that mode long enough and you keep trying long enough and you keep adapting, that's the key. If you keep doing the same thing that's not working, you'll die like a fly in a window. All right, we'll talk more about the fly in a window later, but that's what will happen. You'll die like a fly in a window because you're trying to do something that can't be done. But if you'll be irrationally exuberant and you'll keep trying different, poking at little things, you'll find a path. And that's why it's such an amazing thing to have in your new business or in your new concept for a business or in a business for a new revenue unit or a new product line or something. The same thing can be said, and you have a much faster track because you already have the infrastructure built, right? The product delivery capability or whatever you've put in place to run your existing business. When you're adding on to it, that's way easier than starting from zero, but irrational exuberance can be very beneficial there as well. When you're really seeking success, which you will be in this mode, you grab onto every accomplishment, right? No matter how small it is, and you make it a victory, which keeps you motivated. Five people commented on my shit today. Like today, like five people commented on my shit. I don't care. In the beginning, oh my God, I got five comments and four of them were good. Woohoo! Yay me. I got five new followers. I got three new followers. I got an order, right? Like, when you're in that mode, you grab that shit and you build momentum with it and you keep pouring work back in because of what you would call the positive feedback loop, right? Then the other thing is, it's inevitable if you're pursuing a passion, you will have irrational exuberance. So they feed each other. You'll become more passionate and more exuberant and more exuberant and more passionate, and you'll become unstoppable from a work standpoint. You will go at it with abundance. You will seek everything you can. You will do more work to get a little thing done than you will do, you know, 10 years into it. You'll get much more selective with what you do, which is fine. When you have an established business, you have to be more selective. But in the beginning, when you don't have much at all, you need to try everything to figure out what works. This all does this, but there's like everything. What cuts left, cuts right. There's two sides to the sword here, and that is there's some negatives of irrational exuberance. And one is, just like every little gain is a victory, every little loss is a crushing defeat. Every little loss is a crushing defeat. You had somebody that said they wanted you to come on their podcast or speak at an event or submit an article, or they were going to do something for you, or you were going to do something for them, and there was some partnership, and you were going to go to this thing or whatever, or you had an order that was the biggest order you ever had, but then it got canceled. Whatever it was, it got canceled. It didn't happen. Well, now it was already a little bitty win that you turned into a great big win. Well, now it becomes a great big defeat. And I learned this from one of my mentors in sales, a dude named Forrest Baker. He's still kicking. He's still around. When I went to work for a company called Garrett and as a salesperson, he said that about sales. You get really excited over little bitty things, but you get really depressed over little bitty things. And the key is you need to focus on the positive, but learn from the negative. Whatever didn't work, why didn't it work? Is there anything I could have done? And the answer is yes. Then you make that part of your procedure going forward. If the answer is no, toss it. That's your job. Your job is to quickly identify the things that do not work and eliminate them from your space. If you're a salesperson, a prospect that's not going to buy, that's not even going to give you a meeting, it's never going to give you a meeting. You want to know that? I don't want to spend one more second on that person. The prospect that's going to give you a meeting but never is going to convert, they don't have the money, the budget, the need, whatever it is, you want to explore that rapidly like a surgeon, and that's cancer out against the wall, gone, right? We're not replacing it with anything. We're looking for more. Right. And that is the same way to approach a business. If it's not going to work, if it's not, and I don't mean the business, right? If the technique, the tactic, the channel, whatever, the partnership is not going to work, you need to get hell away from that and find a new opportunity. If you don't, you're going to get really burdened by the failure. You're going to see the failure as a negative when it's really just a feedback loop telling you this is not the way, or the way you did it was incorrect. Adjust your technique. It leaves a lot of room for self-doubt when you are in this mode, because you're the one carrying all the hope, the belief, the spirit, right? You're the one. And if you're small and you're just starting out, you don't even have a team working for you. You're doing everything yourself. You carry the full load. So when anything doesn't work, it just hurts. It just hits. You're just like, why am I doing this? I've had times in my businesses where I'm like, do I really have any business doing this? Or like you're advising somebody and you're having, you're like, do I have any business advising someone when I have this hard thing? Well, you do if you get through it. And it also leaves a lot of room for doubt in your concept, your product, or your service. Like, does anybody, was I just smoking crack, right? Well, I smoking opium when I thought everybody would want this, right? Hummel Mechanics says imposter syndrome is real. Yeah. Like, and it could be imposter syndrome of yourself, like the first thing we were talking about. But this point now, you start having that same kind of doubt about the product or service. And if you can look around and see other people making money off of the thing you're trying to make money off of, it's probably you're doing something wrong, or maybe you picked a place your strength isn't where you thought it was. But most of the time, if you were motivated enough to get off zero, there is something there. And so it is imperative that you continue to poke around and figure out, well, what is my angle? And then realize that a lot of times that answer is really simple. Are you engaged in good, solid information capture on your prospective market? Is your market being followed up with some form of automation? I don't know how many people, they tell me, I'm trying really hard, and you look at what they're doing, they don't even have that done. That's something that's kind of a pain in the ass. It's kind of tedious. If you've never done it before, it may take you a while. By the way, the course we're going to do with GPT, we'll show you how to get GPT to do 90% of the work for you. You don't have to do 10. You still have to learn, but it will help you learn. But if you haven't gotten that done, then you're not maximizing what you have. So who is that? Well, that's the person that says, I want to put solar panels on my roof. And you say, well, why? And they say, because I want to cut my electric bill. And you go over to their house, and it's June. It's 98 degrees out. They have the air conditioner set on 68 degrees, and they have two of the windows in the house open 2 inches. And you're like, the first thing you should do is close fucking windows so the cold air you're paying for don't go out there. And the hot air you don't want doesn't come in. You see what I'm saying? That is so often the case. You look at somebody, I want to put solar in. You go, well, your windows are like from 1961. I can feel air coming in from your window, even though it is closed at least, right? Like that person, if they can't even afford new windows, you ain't going to buy the solar panels anyway. And you probably got no business with that. But that person would probably do well to get really heavy curtains that are designed to keep air out and air in, like weather curtains. Like that's cheap. And that would be step one. Setting up things like information capture, automated follow-up, customer service system, all of that. That's right from the gate what you need to do. The problem with irrational exuberance, you often run straight past it. And again, if it gets you off zero, fine, but that means you're real quick. And like as soon as anything starts coming in, what's going to happen? What happens when somebody fills out a form? What happens next? What happens 5 days later? What happens 20 days later? What does your workflow look like? All of that has to be tuned in. And if you don't do it, you're going to end up with a lot of doubt in the product or service. It might be completely valid. I hope that makes sense. Now, let's talk about some of the things that kill potentially great businesses. And we're already hitting it right there. Probably to go first. And that is equating action with work. I've had people tell me I spend 8 hours a day working in my, and I have a job. So I'm putting 16 hours a day in. But what does that 8 hours entail? What are you doing? Is it effective? If you're doing the same thing every day and your business isn't growing at all, then without knowing what your business is, what your product is, or what you're doing, I already know what you're doing isn't working. I already know that. Now, if you have a very mature business and what you're doing is basically keeping the plate spinning on the, and you're happy with that, that's okay. But we're not talking about that today. We're talking about taking a business that doesn't exist or is really tiny and growing into a level that supports us is what we're really talking about today. Well, if you're working really hard and you're not getting any closer to that, you're doing something incorrectly. And doing more of the incorrect will not help you. It will actually put you out of business faster. I can use pricing to explain this, but labor will work the same way, just might take longer. If I have a product and I'm selling that product at a loss and I'm losing 2% on that product, if I have enough flow of cash through that business, I can probably limp it along for a long time at 2% loss, especially if it's not my only product and it is a loss leader and I'm selling at a 2% loss and I'm bringing business in with it. I'm using it to create a customer database and then I'm selling products that are profitable. Well, I can make that work. But what happens if I don't have a good system set up for that follow-up sale? And I go out and market the shit out of this product and I sell 20,000 units of it at a 2% loss and it's a $200 product. I'm out of business. I'm bankrupt. I can actually move it, even if it would work, if I can move it too fast. If the follow-up cycle is like a 60-day follow-up cycle till the customer begins to become profitable, then I need to throttle the amount in because too much of a negative kills everything. Yeah. Well, if you're working your ass off doing things that are not productively growing your business, you know, you can have a noble ideal. My business is going to have a blog and I'm going to do a blog post every day. But you haven't developed a formula for once that blog post goes out, how do you promote it? How do you cross promote it? What does it do? How does it drive traffic? Where does that, if you haven't put all that together and you just keep doing that, and you make sure you do it every day, and you even do a good job at it, all you're doing is you should have been doing the other things first. So you've got to get the order of operations in the right order of operations is what I'm saying. But if you start equating just action with work, now that's employee. See, you're what you've done is you've moved from the employee seat, which is I put you in a desk, I tell you what to do, and as long as you're doing the things I told you to do, you've done what you're supposed to do. And you can run that calculation at least for yourself in that scenario. And most people do. And if your business is run by competent people, then you will be doing the right things. Because if they figure out it's not working, and it ain't because you're not doing it right, it's because they're applying the workload wrong, they will change up what you're doing, all right? That's your manager's boss, your boss's boss, et cetera, should make those changes for you. Now you've switched over to a new chair. Your chair is you are the CEO and you are the janitor and you are everything in between. And you have to make that decision for yourself. You have to make that realization that this effort being expended on this thing is not effective and I need to stop doing it. Or what you'll find is like I'm putting 80% of my effort here and it's giving me 20% of my results. And I'm putting 20% of my effort here and it's giving me 80% of what my results are. That doesn't mean we stop the other thing, but we need to flip-flop. We need to put 80% of our effort in the thing that gives us 80% of our results and 20% of the effort that's giving us 20% of our results. Maybe those ratios will change in time as the business matures, because as businesses mature, irrational exuberance has to be pushed down and business management has to take over. Then irrational exuberance, we eventually almost put that in a case on the wall, break in case of emergency or opportunity. And we see something and we evaluate it in that very critical way that we do as a business manager. And then we go, but the opportunity's there. Then we can go break that freaking irrational exuberance hat out, put it on, and use it for that project. Okay? So there's a difference in your place in the business of which mode that you need to be in and how you need to control that. But early on, there's a tendency of new entrepreneurs to just work themselves into the ground and yet accomplish nothing. That will kill your business because you will run out of energy before you figure it out if you're not actively looking for it, and you'll quit. And the worst thing is that person is like the prepper that bought like 4 pallets of freaking, MREs and shit and went crazy on guns and everything and shoved it all in their garage. And then they thought the apocalypse was coming, I don't know, 2012, Y2K, whatever they thought doesn't happen. And they're like, boy, that was stupid. I'm never doing that again. Or if they build it into their lifestyle, they become lifelong preppers. Entrepreneurs do the same thing. If you burn out that hard on something, you just think, I am not, like Charles said, you got imposter syndrome. I am not good enough. I did it wrong. Well, maybe you just did the wrong thing. You didn't do it wrong. Next, thinking success will come if I just keep doing. It might seem like the same thing, but it's not. Like these could be things that are even working a little bit, but if they're not the right things, then we need to adapt, we need to adjust, we need to evolve. There is this propensity, and it's very common. That's why I spend so much time on it today. It is very common on people that have never worked for themselves, or even they think they work for themselves, but they were a contractor, maybe a drywall or stonework or who knows what. But when I say contractor, I don't mean that they're a person with a company name on their truck and they're getting individual customers and they're working directly for the customer. When I say contractor that way, you're just talking about the business operational mode. When I say contractor, it's almost like employee light. That's the person that you work under as a general contractor and you do drywall work and I've got a house for you. It needs to be done in the next 4 days. It's over here and you have an agreed upon rate and you show up and you do that work and then you take another job and another job and another job. But somebody else is doing the other side of the transaction for you. People in that mode down to employee, they will get into this idea that when the work is there, you do the work, right? And you do all the work and you always need to be doing something. So do something. But that just can lead to a lot of effort into the things that aren't working. And then if they work a little bit, this belief that if I keep doing it, it'll crest the hill, right? And you need to be critically evaluating and checking that irrational exuberance without throwing it away. Because it's the thing that will carry you in that first 12 to 36 months of building a business from nothing. Basically, you're giving birth to an infant and you're trying to turn it into at least a well-adapted 18-year-old that can function in life without you. That's the goal. That's the best analogy I have for you. And another thing is there is a reality, though, of the freedom. It will always be easier to take a break. It will always be easier to take time off. It will always be easier to say, I'll come back to this project tomorrow. And if you've ever been a foreman on a construction job, you should be able to see the analogy here really, really quick. What happens when you take a break for lunch or just a regular break on a construction job? Everybody's, you know, swinging hammers or running saws or taking measurements or whatever it is that that job entails, running heavy equipment, digging potholes, whatever it is, right? Like everything's going and you call break, 15 minute break, right? Your morning break. So it's not even lunch. You don't end up losing 15 minutes of production, do you? You end up losing at least 30 minutes because everything was running full tilt. You put a full stop to it. And when you bring everybody back, they don't just go straight back to where they were, especially if you're outside of, like in a factory with an assembly line, you push the button, the shit starts running. Lucy's got to pick up the chocolates, right? You do go back to it. But what happens is you get this factory mentality into a dynamic world where everything's always different and always has to be adapted, like building a house. Like it's not going to be exactly the same every time. Okay. And then there is this tendency, people talk, you know, that, you know, just got back and I need to get myself back into work mindset and all. I used to try to do with people is, look, guys, we can take a 30-minute lunch and two breaks, or we can take an hour lunch and no breaks. It's up to you. And most of the time, those guys wanted to do that hour-long lunch. And that didn't mean like when you're working in the heat, people don't take working breaks where you stop for a minute and you drink some water and stuff. But that full sit down, like I got people off of that really quick because I saw how long it took to come back up. Well, when you sit down to do your job and there's like one more piece of it, you know, to get this marketing proposal done or whatever it is you're working on, and you take a break from that, the same thing happens to you individually. Now, there's a place for getting up. There's a place for stopping. What you have to be aware of is it'll always be easier to do that than to power through. And in the early days, you get to be your own bitch. All right? That's the best way I can put it. Like, think of it like if you open a McDonald's franchise, you're going to make less money than the pimple-faced teenager that you hire and train off the street to run the fries in your first year. They're going to think you're a rich corporate greedy fuck, and you're going to make below minimum wage when you factor all your time in. And you could have went to work for Walmart and handed out shopping carts, and you would have been ahead in that first year. But that's the suck. That's the suck. And the suck is what makes it exclusive to people willing to go through the suck. So 5 years into it, when you have two stores and you're worth a couple million bucks and that person's looking at you the same way, they weren't there when you were doing it in the suck. And they're not willing to do it in the suck. So when you do your small business, yeah, you don't have to go borrow $250,000 to give it to McDonald's to get the advantages of a franchise. You still have to go through the suck. And in some ways, it's harder. Because at least in that franchise environment, like they're not going to let you put a McDonald's in a location that's going to be just guaranteed to fail. And they're going to give you a system and they're going to tell you how to, like there's a lot that comes of value with a franchise. They're not a terrible thing. You don't get any of that shit. And again, if you're a solopreneur, your chief bottle washer and your chief operations officer and your CEO and your president and your head of marketing and your head of development, your head of sales, right? So you have to develop a work ethic that is, I know I'm going to work hard and I'm going to be okay with it, but you also have to be doing the right things. So when I started this show, I would get up at about 3:30 to 4:00 in the morning and I would develop a set of note cards so that I would get in my car at 6 a.m. and I would drive between 6 to about 7:15 to my office up in Frisco. So I'd be on the road for about 1 hour and 15 minutes. When I got to my office, it's my frigging company, so piss off if you don't like it. I go in my office and close my door. And people knew, like, Jack's door is closed. First thing, you leave him alone. It would take about 15 minutes to upload the show. It had nowhere near the notes quality and everything it did today, but that got done. That wasn't easy, but it was simple. It was simple, and it always got done. It always got done. And it took being willing to get out of bed and leave my beautiful, warm wife sleeping right next to me and getting out of that bed when it would have been much easier to stay in that bed. Was it actually hard to get out of the bed? It only felt hard. I mean, the physical requirements, pretty, I mean, you do it every day, just at a different time. We've all had times you wake up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you got to pee. It's not, you don't want to, but you get up, you go pee, you go back to bed, right? It's no different except you don't go back to bed. There wasn't anything about it that was difficult, but there was plenty about it that was hard. And if you won't power through the hard, you'll never get past the difficult. All right. Another thing is aiming too low. Well, I just want, then don't be surprised when that's all you get or a little bit less. Generally speaking, if we set the bar for ourselves at 3 foot, we'll end up jumping 2 foot and 11 inches. I mean, we just do. It's just human nature. You've seen it with coaches with the kids trying to get over the hurdles and he's just nicking the hurdle. And instead of putting the hurdle down, you put the hurdle up 2 inches and the kid's like, oh, just try it. Try all you got. And you put them through the hurdles a few times. They knock the hurdle over. You put it back to where it's supposed to be and they go right over it. As soon as you stretch beyond what you think is possible, you get beyond what was possible yesterday. And so if you set a goal for your business to be, you know, $1 million a year business and you never even get close, but your business becomes a $250,000 a year business, assuming you have the right flow, like you should be able to pay yourself $150,000 to $200,000 into your pockets. That might not be what you pay tax on, but in reality, you should be able to do that. As a solopreneur, $50,000 of overhead is pretty friggin' high. So that's a pretty good living. That actually will make you more money than a lot of general practice doctors. But if you set the goal to make $100,000 out of your business, like that's where your design mindset is, then you probably aren't going to get there. The same person doing the same thing will limit themselves by setting their goals too low. Now, I do want to mitigate that a little bit. I do have people say, I want to make $1 million a year. Have you ever made $100 in a month? No. Okay. I want to start with the first goal is to make $100,000 a month or $100 in a month. Cause you have to make that. Now we can double that and you make 200. We can double that. You make 4. We double that. You make 8. We double that. You make 1600. Double that. You make 3200. That's actually decent. But that doesn't mean that we threw away the goal of $1 million a year. We just see those smaller goals as pieces of the whole. If the smaller goal is the whole, then you will achieve less. And nothing will limit an entrepreneur more than setting their bar too low. If you're setting your bar lower than it could be, you better have a damn good reason. You better have a damn good reason. I do. There's a limit to how big TSPC will ever be. And it's because I already was in the other world and I don't want it. I was already in that other world. Now, if I had started this show when I was 24 instead of 36, and I didn't have that 12 years in between of living that exact life I'm talking about, I might have built this much bigger because I might have set that bar. My goal moving here was actually to simplify my life without giving up what I wanted economically. And that's what I built. So I built exactly what I set the goal to build. See how funny that is? So you might as well set a goal that's high enough to be worth all this and failing to meet it by 20%. So hitting 80% of goal is great. If success as you define it doesn't change your life for the better, why are you doing it? Now it's okay to be motivated by little incremental steps. Most people, if you can make enough money in a side hustle to pay the mortgage on your house, your whole life just got better. But let that be a step, not a destination. And so I'm not saying everybody out there, I'm going to make a $10 million business or a $20 million. No, because some people would be, even if you succeeded, you might be really miserable. Now you could build a business like that, and sell it. That's another option. It's doable, but you need to figure it out for yourself. And you need to figure out if you are pushing yourself hard enough with the goal itself, not just the workload. Aiming too low will kill you. It will kill you because what you'll end up with is working really hard to get less and eventually burning out on it. Every business comes down to some very basic things, though. I want to give you some practical how do you achieve success stuff today. One is the ability to market. It's the most important aspect of any business. Let's say that you work really hard and you learn how to build a website instead of just paying somebody to do it. Okay, great. Fine. You know what? It's a skill. It's useful. You're not in a web development business. You probably shouldn't have done it, but okay, you did. And you have a lot of independence and autonomy. So you build yourself a good website. And it's got good images. It's got good messages. It's actually a really great sales tool. Okay. But you don't market. You just put it there and hope somehow people will find it. You just built a really good store in the middle of a desert with no roads leading to it. Once you build that site, and it could be some other, it could be a physical location, right? You have to build roads in from a marketing standpoint, right? If you have a storefront that 10,000 people a day drive by and you put a sign up, that might be all you need. Most of us are not going to be doing that. So social media, search engine marketing, paid advertising, influencer ad. I'm not an influencer, but there's lots of influencers. And believe it or not, they sell their influence for a lot less than you might think. You don't need the influencer with 10 million followers. You need the influencer with 10,000 followers. And how does that work? That works if everybody that comes to your site, that interacts with you, goes on a database. So even though you didn't make any money on that first piece of their traffic, you have the ability to bring them back. And you can bring them back over and over, and you can cultivate them. Because otherwise you're in a mining mindset. I get the customer, I get the deal, they give me their money, I give them the thing, they go away and fuck them. That's a mining business. You have to be a massive corporate oligarchical type business for that to even work. And those guys don't do that anyway because they know what I'm about to tell you works better. And that is once that customer comes in, you do everything you can to keep touching them. Touch them, touch them, touch them. And you want them to feel good when you touch them, good touches. And you want to stay in that customer's mind. And when they need something, again, anything that you can help with, you want them coming back to you. And when they need something you don't have, you want them to see you as a resource to find what they want, because now they found what they wanted because they used to. They love you even more. That is marketing. And that is, it all comes down to one finite, simple definition, and what we call an absolute definition: telling your story. You cannot sell your vision by saying, we have a widget that makes your ass not itch, and that is all. Where did the widget come from? Why did you come up with the widget? How is it different from other widgets? Why should I talk to your company? What are the morals and soft values of your company? I want to feel good about doing business with you. There's just one angle on this. But that's your story. Like, how, what, why? Understanding all of that and then packaging it. And here's the thing. Humans remember stories way more than they remember facts, figures, benefits, features. They remember stories. So I don't care what your religious faith is. And you may never have even been a member of a church. But if I say, tell me the story of David and Goliath, and the person, you know, has an IQ of at least 95, right? And they're functional, and they can breathe on their own. They don't need somebody to breathe for them. Probably 90% or more of people can tell me the story. They might not get it exactly right. They might not be able to quote you, but they can tell me the story of David and Goliath, right? And the slingshot, and they might even know that the sling was like a sling instead of a slingshot, right? Like, but they know the basic story, and they can tell the basic story. And they probably could have told the story at 12. They could have told the story at 25. They could tell the story at 50. And if their faculties remain at all a couple days before they croak, they can tell the story. Why? Because the stories stick with us. Every major religion in the world is built on stories. And I don't care if it's Islam, if it's Judaism, if it's Christianity, if it's Buddhism, if it's Hinduism, the shamanic faiths, they're all story-based. Because we pass stories. So if you can effectively condense your offering into a story, then you can sell. Because if you can tell the story, right, then you can get viral marketing next. If I tell my story enough, you'll tell it for me. That's viral marketing. Get somebody else to tell your story. The stuff I'm giving you here at the end, guys, this is the meat of building a business. You can go spend thousands of dollars. And if you learn these few things in that thousands of dollars of sales and how to apply them, you probably get your money's worth. I'm giving them to you for free. This is the core philosophy of business development. So you have to have the ability to tell the story and get others to do it. And to do that, we have to condense the story into something that people that have some affinity with. Right. A lot of you, if I brought you with me to a trade show and somebody came up and said, well, how did all this start? You could sit down and tell them the story of how the whole business started. Because Jack's talking to somebody else right now. He used to get in his car with his little record to tell the story. Right. When you get that into your marketplace where they will repeat it, you've got all the marketing you need, but you might have to do conventional marketing to get there. I did a lot of paid marketing in the beginning. It wasn't huge amounts of money, but it was a lot of time managing it. Fortunately, I knew how to do it. I did Google AdWords. I did a product called Stumble Upon. I advertised with them. I did a lot of things. I got on radio shows. I got on other people's podcasts, right? So that was telling my story and getting other people to do it. Well, then that's great. So now you have eyes on you. Now you have people coming to you. Now you have people filling out your web form or following on social media, whatever. You've marketed. You've told your story and you've attracted attention. And you get absolutely no money for that, right? Maybe you can make some money on YouTube as an influencer with, you know, which means that if you do get big and you piss them off, they can just turn off your money. So I will not turn down that money, but I will not rely on it. Yeah. So to get your money, now I have to sell you something. I have to give you a reason for you to say, Jack, here's my money. I will buy your book. I'll become a member of your course. I will buy this product you recommend that you earn a commission on. I will do something that puts money in your pocket because you brought me value. How do I do that? Another absolute definition, transfer of belief. That is a concrete three-word absolute definition of a sale. Transfer of belief. Nothing else is required if you understand it. I took my belief that this thing would benefit you, and I transferred that belief to you. And the minute that was done, if you have the need and you have the money, and there's nothing prevent, like, you know, like, have the money, but this week's going to be tight, so you don't really have the money. If you actually, like, if the money is inconsequential and I've transferred the belief properly, and I've identified you as a prospect properly, you're going to buy from me. You might not buy this week, but you're going to buy from me. It's going to happen. Because the parts fit. The puzzle pieces go together. So if you can get that down, tell your story, get other people to tell your story, and transfer your belief in the product or service you offer, and you can package that and do it in a way where the person can repeat why they did business with you, it's going to be very unlikely that you're not going to succeed if you follow all the other rules of businesses like the show we had last week. Then you also have to have, to go with that, the ability to build that customer base and retain it. You have to do something to cultivate those customers. They have to feel like they matter to you. A daily podcast, a daily email, a weekly email. Recognizing, like, if they're, especially if they're in a particular niche, things that are important to people in that niche. Every time you touch a customer, you shouldn't necessarily be asking them for money. If you every time you email somebody, say, give me money, eventually, like, oh, it's an email from him, he wants money. If you send an email that says, hey, this thing in the news just happened and here's how it affects people that might be in our customer base, and the next time they get an email, it's, here's this great holiday and it's not a holiday sale, we just want to recognize it. And then the third email they get is, hey, we have this new product offering. They're going to be much more receptive than every single time you're trying to take something. Give more than you get. That's an additional rule of business. I don't know if I've ever quite put it that way, but you have to prime the pump, right? You have to give before you take. You should give way more value than you ask for, because then people will give you way more value than you ask for. People will do things that sometimes you'll feel a little bit uncomfortable with. Like, I don't know if I deserve, that's the imposter syndrome creeping in there again. But that's how you build that effective nature. You have to retain and build the customer base and cultivate it. And you have to either sell a product or a service or both. Both is good. A serviced product is really good. Like, if you're like Humble Mechanics here, unless he's left by now, I'm sure he would agree with this. The fact that I can have a car dealership and sell you the car, but I also provide you the financing and I provide you the maintenance. Those are two different services. When I sell you a car, my hope is that when your odometer hits 3,000, 5,000, whatever mileage is on your maintenance schedule, that you're pulling that car right back to where you bought it, going into my shop, and my technician is servicing it. See, that's a service product. The most profitable thing car dealers are doing and have been doing for about the last 10 years, maybe more really, is specializing in trying to put people in leases. Do you know why? If I lease you the car, most of the time I am providing the financing, number one. So now I've got the service of the financing, plus I've got the car being quote unquote sold, because it is in many ways a sale. Yeah, I'm just selling you the use of the car for 3 years instead of you buy the car and go away. Because you're leasing from me, it is much more likely that you're going to get your maintenance from me, because you know the most likely thing you're going to do is bring the car back to me. Now, most customers aren't aware of this, but you don't have to. If you have a car near the end of a lease and you're thinking about buying a different, not just a different car model, but a different make, you're driving a Toyota and you're thinking about buying a Ford, you go to Ford, they'll work a trade with you on that, because at least the underlying car has value, right? There's an unsold portion of the car and there's what you owe, and the difference, you might be able to take the right leased vehicle to a different make manufacturer's dealership and still get money out of it. But most people don't think that way. So I buy the Toyota in a lease for 3 years from Toyota. So I take the Toyota for service at Toyota. I keep the financing for Toyota. And what do I do on month 36 of that lease? I return the car. Most people, when they return a car, they don't want to really return the car. They need a new car. Because they have the car. Like, if you had a third fund vehicle for 3 years, you just, here's the car, give me whatever I get out of it, or here's the, you know, termination fee, whoever owes who, you settle and you're gone. That's 95% of those leases, when they terminate, the person brings them back and they need a new car. Now they're talking to the salesperson. If the guy's not a quick in and out sales guy, he's been around a while, you're talking to the same guy you dealt with last time. Trust is already there. Now that dealership can say, we can convert it to a buy. We can look for another vehicle for you to buy, or we can get you another lease. So that is perfect cultivation of a market. And that's why so many dealerships, when you go and say, I don't want a lease, I just want to buy, they still put the lease in front of you. They still put the lease in front of you. Humble says, and the car they trade is a top level used car. Exactly. Exactly. Because it was on a lease. So it was maintained the entire time. The dealership knows it was maintained the entire time because they did the maintenance, and it's low mileage because the lease usually comes with a mileage restriction. So that 3 year car is looking at 36 to 45,000 miles. With the way they build vehicles today, I know you think they're worse than they used to be. They're not, right? And this is not really about the subject, but I want to bust that myth. They don't build them like they used to. Yeah. And thank God. Now there was a nice thing. If I bought a 1968 car in 1988, that was 20 years old, I could work on it. Very easy to work on. Simple. Everything in it you could see, you can get to, easy to work on. But when you bought a 1968 car, unless it was something like a 68 Camaro in 1988, you bought it for a few hundred dollars. But I'll even take it further. My first car, I bought 1986. It was a 75 Grand Prix. 1975 Pontiac Grand Prix. It had about 100,000 miles on it. It was in some rough shape, but the interior was actually beautiful. $300 I paid for it. First thing I had to do was put a new transmission in it within about 2 weeks, and I knew that was going to happen, but I got a junk transmission for like $75 and a rebuild kit for like $25. Rebuilt the transmission, put it in myself. And so all in, let's call it $500. I drove a car for 2 years. It was a 10-year-old car. It was a 12-year-old car, 11, 12 years old. What's an 11, 12-year-old car worth today? Yeah, see? You ain't buying it for $300, are you? And the reason that we were able to buy those 10-year-old cars, it's not just an inflation thing. It's a factor. But it's because that car at 10 years was fucked up. It was worn the fuck out. A 10-year-old car today, if it's maintained, it might as well be new. How many cars did you see if you're around in the 1980s with 250,000 miles on them that were not just rolling buckets of shit, you find cars all the time now that look good, that run good. I mean, they're going to need maintenance, and they might even be at the end of life of that engine in another 100,000 miles. But there's plenty of them with over 200,000 miles on them. For a car to be over 100,000 miles in the 80s was rare, unless it was a specific thing, like a salesman's car that was all highway mileage or something. They make cars better than they used to. They're just more expensive and more complex with more technology. But anyway, let's get back to the main thing here. What we're really talking there is about selling the product, the service, or both. So when we sell to a customer, what we're saying is we have value and we're going to deliver you value. And in return, we want the economic value that you've saved up in your battery, or if you're going to finance it, are willing to commit to your energy you're going to spend in the future and give us. So that's the value for value nature of that exchange. And that means that the customer has to look at your product and or service and see one of three things. And it's only three things in that product or service. They have to see profit. They have to see something that's life changing, or they have to see something that's educational. And honestly, profit is really a good enough answer for all of them. But I want you to think right now, try to break that. The easiest way to try to break what I just said is that, well, if I go see a new movie, my life's not going to change. You know, it's a Star Wars movie and Disney fixed it or something. It is not going to really teach me anything. And I don't leave with any more money than I came in with. But you profited because you purchased entertainment. When we exchange money for entertainment, you ride a zip line, you get to jump out of an airplane and skydive or whatever. That's what you're doing. You're profiting by having an experience that may enter the world of life-changing, but if nothing else, it entertains you. When you take your kids to the zoo and they look at the elephants and the tigers and everything, and they smile and you get that one picture that was like you went through hell because the kids were going nuts and the food was really expensive and all, but you get that one picture where everybody's just happy, and you go home and your kids are like, I saw the lion and the lion had a baby and it licked up, or whatever it is. That was your profit. That was your profit. Now, it can be a direct profitable thing. If I'm selling a thing that makes you money, I don't know why you didn't buy it already. My membership is that. If you use it, it makes you money. You give me $50, and this year you save $150. You just put $100 in your pocket. I don't know why you haven't bought it already. That's a little clue there. Maybe you should, right? It's okay to ask for money when you run a business, especially if you're providing value. But that is a profitable thing. Then life changing is a lot. What a lot of podcasts are really selling is that your life will change because you listen to my show. If you listen to a show and it's all about news, it's like a podcast version of Fox News or Newsmax or CNN. It doesn't really change your life. It just feeds you outrage. But a lot of podcasts, they're bringing on guests you'd never hear from any other way. They're talking about things that change the direction in your life or the way you look at things. First time I heard Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson on Joe Rogan, I was like, everything about the way I looked at history changed. It was life changing. It didn't necessarily mean I was inspired, but my life changed. Now here's the golden trifecta. The company that sells one thing or sells a total package that is profitable, life changing, right? And educational. If you can do all three, you've got the golden trifecta. Even if you don't start out there, that's the way to build a company toward that direction. Because if your customer feels like, I would have less, I would actually have something missing in my life if I wasn't doing business with this company. And I am financially better off because I do business with this company. And I know more about things that are important to me because I do business with this company. Why would they ever leave you? Why would they ever leave you? They wouldn't. You got something that pays you to be there, alters your life view in a way that makes it better, and you'd miss it if it was gone. And you know more because of it. You're not going anywhere. And you know what you become? Not only do you become a very loyal customer, you become a very sticky customer. Loyal just means they're going to keep doing business with you. But they're loyal to the point where, but if company B comes along, and I think they can do all those things too, then maybe I'll go over to company B, right? But if you really do it right, they develop an affinity for you. Maybe I'll add company B, but I ain't letting A go. You want to be A in that model. Now, I want to talk about the whole premise today, though, that building a business is hard. And we started out with something that usually when you have somebody that wants to inspire you to build a business, which I do, I actually want to do more this year with business shows than I have in the past. I want to do, because it's the number one thing I think that can bring you freedom in your life. It really is. I don't think there's anything that you can do for yourself with more freedom. And I'll put it to you this way. When we do like in real life things, workshops and all, there's plenty of people there that have jobs, but the vast majority of people have a business. And it's not just a money thing. Because you can have money, but do you have time? Let's say our fall workshop, we do that. You show up Wednesday and you go home Sunday morning. Well, a lot of people, that means Tuesday's gone too. They're going to travel Tuesday. So that's almost a full week. And it includes a weekend that an employee like goes, man, my weekend, that's me time, right? You know? So when the person runs their own business, they can structure things a lot easier so they can be there. And the employees that come, these are people generally, they're like, they run departments. They're head engineers that have a team working for them. There are people that there's one person that approves their vacation, not 12. They've gotten to this. They're almost like a warrant officer in their job, right? For those that know military things, like an officer and an enlisted have a very clear delineation and very clear roles in the military. And both of them have to do a certain amount of ass kissing up the chain. Even someone like a captain or a major has plenty of asses above him to kiss. A warrant officer is kind of like this weird contractor inside the military, especially if they're a warrant and they're, you know, the pilots, a lot of warrant officers are helicopter pilots in the Army anyway, and they have a lot of that autonomy. But when a dude is like, he was a motor sergeant and then he went warrant at some point and now he's like a CW3 and he's like the BMO, the battalion motor officer. His world is so different. Then the company commander has more grief to deal with than that battalion motor officer does. He just, he runs things his way and it's very hard for him to end up in trouble. And he can be told by people that technically outrank him, he has to do something. He can say, I'm not doing it. Here's why, go away. And he can get away with it. Most of the employees that come to these events, most, not all, but most of them, that's the kind of employees they are. They have the money and they have the time. And the entrepreneurs have the money and they have the time. I've been on Humble Mechanic about coming to my workshop. We just talked by email. He's not coming because he's going to do another event that's like his biggest event of the year, and it's always the same time frame. So that's the only reason he can't come, not because he doesn't have the time, because he's choosing to put his time somewhere else, and he should based on his business. But that time freedom, there's nothing more valuable than the freedom to control your own life. And that's why I want to teach more about this, because I know many of you, you want it. And there's a lot of you that are this close to having it. And for those that are not on the video, I've got my fingers about 2 inches apart. And what I mean is you've got a side hustle that will scale, but you just have to figure out how to scale it. You know, you're not just selling eggs to neighbors. That's not going to scale unless it becomes a in-the-door product and you scale it some other way, right? But there's a lot of people that, like, your business as it is can scale. You just need to see the vision and you need to connect the dots. And that's why, again, this AI thing we're going to do is going to be geared in that direction. And it is going to kind of wrap around the release of the book on the 12th of May. Because if you don't want to build a business after reading that book, I don't, you know, and you don't need to build a business for that book to benefit you. But if you don't want to do it after that, you probably won't ever. Because it will really make the case to you that, like, you get one life, right? The dash, the hyphen, you know, you're going to die someday. And somewhere, someplace, you're going to be eulogized And they're going to say, you know, Jack Spirko, 1972 to 2112, right? I ain't going to live that long. That's crazy. But you get what I'm saying. And in the middle, there's a dash. That dash will be you. And no matter how long you're going to be 100 years old, it still gets shorter every day. If you're going to be 100 years old when you die and you're 50, you're already halfway there to death. And most of us ain't going to make 100. What are you going to do with that dash? When you work for somebody your whole life, especially in a job you don't really love. I mean, if you love your job, you're well paid, you can take vacation. Like, if your life is really great with a job, keep your job. Right? I know I'm not supposed to say that, but I'm going to. If your life is perfect with your job, if you're treated well, you're paid well, you have enough freedom, you love what you do, and you can't, and if you did start a business, you'd basically be doing what you do for yourself. That if you could do anything you wanted, you would still be doing. You are in a great position and you should stay there. But if you don't check all those boxes, what you're doing effectively is that dash, you're selling a piece of it every day to your employer. Somebody's buying your life. Again, if you can make that work really well for yourself, and a lot of people do. I know a lot of blue-collar millionaires that have never done a single thing to actually run a business in their life. They've worked for somebody, you know, they're senior aerospace engineers, an uncle of mine is one example. Like, he's passed now, but he never, like, another uncle of mine lived just north of my dad named Pete. Uncle Pete, great uncle Pete. He was my grandfather's brother. Worked for Cressona Aluminum for 35 years. Loved his job, loved everybody he worked with. Went hunting and fishing, took time off to go hunting and fishing every year. Trained his dog. Now, he did have an entrepreneurial side to him. He was a pigeon breeder in a place where pigeon matches were still a thing. I won't get into that today. But that was a very small offshoot side business of his. He retired. He was a staff sergeant in the Army before he came back to being a civilian. He was a staff sergeant during World War II. Went to work for Cressona Aluminum and stayed there his whole freaking career. And he was totally happy. That man, I can't see him have done anything else. But are you him? Because if you're not, this is a way out. This is a way out. It's hard. But why is it good that it's hard? Why is something valuable? Why does something have value? It has value because it's rare. And the more rare it is and functional it is, the more valuable it is. And something that's really functional, super functional, something you might use in your life on a daily basis, but it's not rare. And it's been commoditized to the point where it's digital and freely available, has no value. There might be somebody out here who can break this because you're some kind of special person or something and you have a requirement for a physical calculator. But most people in this audience, most people that will hear this show, you know, the next 48 hours after it's released, you haven't bought a calculator, some of you ever in your life. But if you're my age, you know, you probably had, like, I took accounting classes in school, so I had a calculator for accounting class. Today, if I had a calculator for accounting, or I had accounting classes, I wouldn't have a calculator. Well, I would, but it's free. It's on my phone. So is a calculator valuable? Yeah. But can you sell it anymore? No. Why? It's too abundant. It's not rare enough. So what would happen if really anybody could build a successful business? How many employees would there be? They'd all be really small businesses, and they'd all have very limited scale because you would have to take the few people that really just don't want it at all, even if somebody handed it to them, to hire. That'd be a lot of competition for labor, very limited labor pool. And no, and most businesses wouldn't be highly profitable because everybody would be making a relatively similar wage since everybody can do it. Remember I talked about the value of labor at the beginning? That's why. Right. The value of labor. And there's going to be an expansion on that for the expert panel show. But the value of labor is simply if you work for me, but whatever you do for me, I can train somebody else to do in a week. And there's 50 applicants that want your job and you're a pain in my ass. You're fired. I don't care. There's no need for me to retain you if I don't like you and you don't work out well and I can easily replace you. Conversely, you can be a dickhead. But if you're like a high-level engineer that's programming algorithms self-learning algorithms into my software. I used to have a guy that worked for me. That's exactly what he was doing. He was a dick. You know what? Don't care, because he's the only person that we could afford that can do this. Well, that's how a business is. The reason a dude can make a living like I make with a podcast like I have is because it's not easy. It's because it's not easy. You should be grateful that it's hard. If it's not hard, why would you do it? Why would you do something that isn't hard? Because everybody else is going to do it too, so it can have any real value. If you can build a business in just about any realm, you can make a living. Especially in the world of technology. If you can deliver your product for very low to no cost, but yet it's still a limited thing, it's still something that they can't get from just anybody else, then you can scale very easily to 3 annual incomes of the median salary in your area of operation. How's that work? 1,000 true fans model. It's about 333, right, per third. And 1,000 true fans model came out of the music industry. It's very simple. You have 1,000 people who love what you do so much, they'll spend one day's wages on you per year. That will work out to just under 3 times the median salary for your marketplace. If you can't live on that, you're doing something wrong. And if you can't grow from there, you're doing something wrong. So really, because it's hard, simply with a dedicated customer base of 1,000 people, you can have a lifestyle better than most people in the country. That's kind of crazy, but it's only true because it's fucking hard, or everybody would do it. It would commoditize business ownership down to employment status and devalue it, just like degrees. I remember the 1980s, if you got out of high school and you went to college, you got decent grades, and you had any meaningful degree, there were jobs waiting for you. There were jobs waiting for you. Like the way people think it is today, it actually was that way. It didn't mean it was super easy. It didn't mean you might not pay your dues. It didn't mean that your first job might pay not much more than you could have made going to work doing a construction job. But it was a good entry-level position with a pathway up. And the reason was simple. The number of people that an employer could look at in that starting position, 22, 23 years of age, with a college degree in the right field that had done well with it, was quite limited. Today, they're churning it out like a diploma factory. Like 70 to 80% of people go to college. They don't all graduate, but 70 to 80% of people go to college. When I was a kid in school, like half, 50% went, 50% didn't. In some areas, it's almost 100%. When my niece graduated high school, every single student, when they were announced at graduation, was either going to a tech school, it was very few, the military, very few. It was well over 90%. 9 in 10 of those kids, they already knew exactly what college they were going to. Nobody said undecided, whatever. When I was in school, there were tons of people. When they graduated, you didn't know what they were going to do. You know? They had no idea where they were going or what they were going to do next. So because there's more, the value is less. That's how businesses work. And the beauty of it is that we could add 100,000 businesses in the United States this year, and that would not make them not rare. They would still be rare, and you could still make a really good living doing it. So with that, I want to remind you guys you can help support this show a few ways. One is by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I do try to bring you products that I think will enhance your life. This one's not for everybody, but for a lot of folks, this product can pay for itself. It's a 10-inch commercial meat slicer. It's made by Vavor. It's the exact one I have. There's a video in the write-up today. Shot by my grandson, by the way. And honest to God, if you read the article, it'll tell you everything you need to know about how you can actually make this thing pay for itself. But it could be as simple as if you live near a Costco business center and you buy things like ham and turkey and roast beef from the deli, and you go to the Costco business center and you buy the same whole piece of it that the grocery store buys for a third of what it costs when you buy it from them and slice your own meat, it will pay for itself that way. You learn to make your own roast beef, especially using a low cost cut like Eye of Round. You can go look what roast beef costs and go make the roast beef the way I tell you to, and see what you think. You'll be like, okay, I make better roast beef for about 30% of the cost, right? You can see how it pays for itself. But today it will pay for itself even faster. Why? Because it's on sale. They have it on sale at like 16% off, and then I get you an extra 5% through my special discount code with my direct relationship. So 21, really call it 20%, about 20% discount on a product that's already really priced well. But one thing I'll tell you about this product. When I got mine, I'm like, what kind of piece of shit is this? Because I took a piece of meat and I tried to cut it, and it wouldn't cut worth a damn. And I don't know if this is common, but it shipped with the blade not sharpened. And there could be a reason for that. I haven't heard from anybody else said they got one like this. But it's a built-in sharpener. So I'm like, dummy, try the sharpener. So I ran the built-in sharpener. You basically squeeze it and turn it on, and it runs a little bit. And then I'm like, oh, this is what I expected. This is what I expected. It's an awesome tool. The other thing I want to let you know about, last week I brought you the DeWalt cordless pruner. And it was on sale, and the sale is gone. They're back up to like $180, and that's the pruner plus a 2-amp-hour battery and a charger. Don't buy that. The only reason I'm bringing it around today is last week when I brought you the kit that was on sale for like $139, which was a decent deal, Amazon didn't have any bare tools of these in stock. You had to buy them from third-party vendors. Guess what? Now, and this is DeWalt's. DeWalt does a real good job of gilding and controlling the flow of their products. And when they have certain market conditions, they won't put things on sale, but they'll put other things on sale. And that's what they've done here. And so the bare tool is now $89. If you're going to get one of these, get the bare tool. You can buy like 4 2-amp-hour batteries for the price difference there. Don't do that. This is probably a tool more for the person already on DeWalt platform anyway. You probably already have batteries. But I said something last week, and somebody called me. Sure you do, Jack. I said, I love this thing so much I have two of them. And I actually had somebody call me a liar on social media that I do not have two of these, because why would you? Because they're fucking cool. That's why, bitches. Right here. That's why. I got two of them because two of them are better than one of them. Screw you, okay? No, it's serious. It really is a great product. It really is a great product. It does a great job, and it's been very beneficial to me in having my wife and my grandson do certain things that they just physically cannot do with a pair of hand pruners. And somebody said they wouldn't trust a kid with it. Well, your kid's not my kid, okay? My kid has been taught safety and all types of things since he was a little bitty. And so he's 14, and I totally trust him using one of these, especially when we're around, which we generally would be. Great tool. Check them out. And, yeah, the reason I got two is because two is better than one. Two is one, and one is one, baby, right? Anyway, with that, I will be gone. Your builder says, what about the mini chainsaw? Bro, I don't have time to get the mini chainsaw review out this week. I'm getting on an airplane Wednesday morning. I got two more shows to produce this week, but it is coming. The DeWalt mini chainsaw is badass, and that will be coming really, really soon. Thanks to everybody that tuned in today. Again, you got rewinds coming at you tomorrow, and you got rewinds coming at you Wednesday. And then we got Thursday, we got expert counsel. By Thursday, I'm not back to regular, but you are as a listener. Monday, I'll be back. We'll do something brand new out of the gate. Again, check out Laws of Life, the book. Just go to the website, the Survival Podcast, scroll down, you'll see it, fill out the form, you'll get a notice. I'm going to say ambassador spots are pretty much gone at this point. Like I said, there was one gold left, but I would love it if you pick up a copy. And please do this for me, all of you guys. Like, we know we're going to sell a lot of these out of the gate. We really do. We have a couple hundred registered either to be an ambassador. Actually, we have several hundred either to be ambassador or just buy one. If 20% of y'all will review the book for me within 2 weeks after you get it, an honest review, including Jackson asked, this sucks. I can't believe how bad this was. I liked him otherwise. I don't even care if I have some negative reviews. Fine, whatever. I don't know. Maybe you don't like the typesetting. Maybe you don't like the font. I don't care. If you guys will review it for me, that means every bit as much as buying it. Because if I get good sales and good reviews out of the gate, we can really use this to grow the TSP community. And that is my plan. I didn't do it just so I could say I'm also an author. Everything I do in my business is holistic and roped in together. And this is designed to make the TSPC community bigger. So if you can help by that, by picking up at least one copy and reviewing it for me, that would be great. Thank you, and I will catch you guys officially when I get back next week. Run you round.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.